Okay, we're ready to get started. Those who were here last week know that we still have about 10 minutes of stuff dealing with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, but I do want to respond to some things that were raised in the last class, which we didn't get a chance to. To begin with, okay, I'm going to lower my microphone volume here, and I'm going to unplug the phone. To begin with, Rabbi Kelman asked about the Sri Deish and calling someone up, counting someone in a minyan who was intermarried, and I recalled it that the Sri Deish did not permit it, and Rabbi Kelman recalled it differently. Well, I checked it, and indeed the Sri Deish says that you cannot call up someone who's intermarried, count someone in a minyan who's intermarried. He says because it's a way of, it's migdar milta, which means that this is a like a punishment, or it's an emergency measure to prevent people from intermarrying. We show that they're not counted. I don't know if today that would be applicable, since no one who's about to be intermarry, at least not in any community other than the Syrians perhaps, is scared away by the idea that you won't count them in a minyan. They're not going to be going to an Orthodox minyan to begin with. The Sri Deish incidentally does think that it's probably a good idea for a parent to go to a child's intermarriage so as to not lose contact with them. Two other things. Someone asked me about Ettlinger and Mitzitza. To further clarify it, Ettlinger, as we spoke about, was strongly in support of Mitzitza. Now, he was speaking about Mitzitza Beped because they didn't have tubes like we have today. They only had a gauze, but this, you can't really cite him as being a supporter of Mitzitza Beped, because we don't know what he would have said had there been a tube. What's the problem with using a tube? All we can say is that he's a strong supporter of Mitzitza. And finally, I misspoke about Hirsch. I said that Hirsch was a student of Ettlinger for a few months. He actually was a student for a year and a half, although I just decided to look in Wikipedia, because it's always interesting to see if they get it right, and they actually have him studying with Ettlinger for 6 years, from 1823 to 1829. Well, in 1823, he was only 15 years old, and he was in the gymnasium. He didn't go to Ettlinger till he was 20 years old. So, as again, you cannot always trust what you see in Wikipedia. Okay, let's pick up where we left off. I have about between 5 and 10 more minutes of more material about Ettlinger before we move into Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. We ended last class. I was pointing out something that Ettlinger brings down, and it's the only source, and it's pretty much become the practice in the Orthodox world. He reported that Rav Nassim Adler, and I won't go into what we spoke about last week about him, but he said that women should come to shul to hear Parsha Zachar. Now, following this, and Ettlinger quotes him, you have a few achronim who agreed that it's a good idea. It makes sense. But there are no rishonim who say this. There's no Talmudic source for it. Why did it pick up? In general, we're very strict about Parsha Zachar, as I'm sure you all know. We're very mocked on it. We read it very slowly. We are very quiet so that women can hear it because it's a biblical obligation. In fact, we read it twice, the word Zecher. This was not done until about 100 years ago. We read Zecher with its Seire, and then we read it Zecher. And something which, correct me if I'm wrong, but certainly I've only seen in the last 3 or 4 years, I never saw this 10 years ago, at least not in any of the shuls I was in, they don't just say Timcha es Zecher Amalek, Timcha es Zecher Amalek, or even Timcha es Zecher, Zecher. They read the entire pasuk over. You read it once with Zecher and another time with Zecher. And again, I've only seen this in the last few years. It's another, I wouldn't even say it's a chumrah, because there's no reason to, Chabad practice is actually just to repeat the word, but it's another example of people trying to, cover all the bases, but I don't know of anyone anywhere who says that it's even a chumrah to read the whole pasuk again, and I'm not sure exactly where this started, but I've seen it in a number of shuls, and this year in March, or when we come around to it, pay attention and see if they do that. The problem is that there's a little bit of dispute, beginning with the Vilna Gaon, over how you're supposed to read that word. There's no dispute as far as the medievals are concerned, but the Mishnah Berurah suggested you read it twice, and that's why people do it. Now, Ettlinger believes that the reason Rav Nosson Adler required women to come to shul to hear Parsha Zachar is because it's not a positive time-bound commandment. It's not a mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama. It's just that the rabbi said we do it this time before Purim, but it can be any time. It doesn't have to be then. So that's not a zman grama. And there's other reasons, though, to say women aren't obligated. Even if you say it's not a mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama, the Sefer HaChinuch says women are not obligated for the simple reason that it's war. And women are not obligated in war. I don't want to get into the dispute of how to view a mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama. There's a lot of discussions about Sefiras HaOmer. Are women obligated in that? In fact, if you look in Kiddushin, there's a lot of discussion there about a woman. Is she obligated to circumcise her son? And they bring psukim here back and forth, and Tosfos there asks the question, well, why don't they just say it's a mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama? And he gives an answer, well, it's not really, because after the eighth day, every day you have to give the bris. But one of the commentaries, the Rishash on the spot, actually says that it's not a mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama for a different reason. A mitzvah saseh sh'azman grama is when the Torah tells us this day everyone must do it. But when it comes to a bris, it's individual. Everyone has a different day. Every day there's different bris going on. There's no one day for everyone to do it. Let me quote one more famous responsa, because it's worth knowing, and it's often cited. It's one of his famous ones. Autopsies. If there's something that every Jew knows, or every religious Jew knows, it's that Jews don't do autopsies. It's wrong, except for maybe in emergencies, or there's a disease we don't know about. But the idea that you just do it, that's wrong. And, of course, with most everything that we think we know, it's not always the case. And so, and this is one example. Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, in two tshuvot, in Binyan Sion, number 170 and 171, says that why are autopsies forbidden? Because we have this concept of nivul hameis, that we have to have respect for the dead person. However, Ettlinger says, if the dead person gives his permission in his lifetime that you can dissect him, anything you want to do with him, there no longer is a concept of kavod hameis, of respect for the dead. And therefore, according to the Binyan Sion, Ettlinger, anyone can will their body to science, and it can be, the medical students can work on it, and there's no problem with that whatsoever, because you can waive your right to honor. And in Rabbi Greenwald's book, Rabbi Leopold Greenwald from Columbus, Ohio, he wrote the book Kolbo al Avelot. For two generations, this was the standard Avelos textbook, until about 15 years ago, some new ones came out. In this book, he quotes Halacha L'maisa, for practical application, Ettlinger's opinion. He was telling this to all the rabbis in America, everyone used this book, that if someone wants to donate their body to science, there's nothing wrong with it. It's interesting, I looked at it just before, Greenwald goes on and says that if you don't have permission to perform an autopsy on someone, it's a serious sin if it's a Jewish person to do it. So Greenwald says that those people who are so concerned about the state of medicine and whose children are going to medical school to become doctors, Greenwald suggests that step up to the plate. Each one of you should donate your body to science, and therefore the doctors of the world, the future doctors, and your children will have bodies upon which to work. Now, needless to say, this is not shared by everyone, this opinion, although I don't think that the traditional Jewish reticence when it comes to autopsies really has to do with halachic reasons. I think it has more to do with non-halachic factors, that this idea of tchiyat hametim, and people are afraid, what's going to happen to their bodies. But be that as it may, that's a psak, and I would assume it's one that people can rely upon if they were so. The Note of Yehuda did not allow an autopsy for to be carried out unless there was a real need, and you had a person who standing right before you that needed the medical information. Although you have people like Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg and Rabbi Uziel and others that say today you could do an autopsy in Moscow and tomorrow or that day, the information could save a life in New York. Note of Yehuda wasn't talking about a case where someone wills their body to science. There's no question, as far as I remember. There's no question people disagreed with the Binyan Sion. The Maram Shik is most famous. But that was the Binyan Sion's position, and it makes sense, because when it comes to kavod, people, except for a melech, a king is not allowed to waive his kavod, but everyone else, fathers, revis, they can waive their kavod. It's a machlok, it's about revis, whether it's kavod Torah belongs to him or not, but most believe it's his kavod to waive, so they could say, don't stand up if I walk in the room, etc. So that's the Binyan Sion's point. I had a case, this is a practical application, of someone I know who, someone in the family wanted to donate their body to science, and it was in the will, and the child wanted to follow the will. And the question was, should we try to convince the child not to honor the will? Because at the end of the day, the will is meaningless. It's what the children decide. And if the children wanted to honor the will, and obviously if it was cremation, you're not allowed to honor a will, even if the person wanted to be cremated. But donating your body to science, again, either you would rely on Ettlinger, or you ask a shayla to a rav, and let the rav decide whether, Ettlinger's opinion is such that you can rely upon. But it is very significant. And we hear from Binyamin that the Chazon Ish allowed a person to donate their body. That I didn't know. That's interesting. Would this tshuva apply in the case of the $25 million funeral? We heard that story. Was it last week? I don't know where I heard that story. I forget what the details were with the $25 million funeral. I forget the details. If it's something like cremation, obviously it's not allowed. If it's something like bury a Jew in a place they're not allowed to be buried, you don't do that either, because there's various halachot. But autopsies, nivel hameis, that can be waived for the good of others. It's not just that you can take them apart, but for the good of others, Binyan Sion thinks that can be waived. Okay, unless there's any other questions about Rav Yaakov Ettlinger, we're going to move on to his Talmud Mubak, Rav Israel Hildesheimer. That's where I saw it, in the latest tradition. Okay, so thank you. Okay, it's a truism that the two greatest Orthodox, German Orthodox figures in the 19th century, certainly in the second half of the 19th century, are Samson Raphael Hirsch, who we dealt with two courses ago, and Israel Hildesheimer. And we will see some important differences between them. Both of them were students of Rav Yaakov Ettlinger. Now let me give you the brief biography of Hildesheimer. He was born in Halberstadt in Germany in 1820, and he died in 1899. He studied much longer with Ettlinger than Hirsch. Hirsch studied a year and a half. Ettlinger studied from 1837 to 1842, 5 years. We know that he was a great matzmid, a great learner. And in later years, he would become, I guess, what some might call more normal, there is evidence that at this time, Torah study was all that interested him, and he's quoted as saying as follows. When he studied with Rav Yaakov Ettlinger in Altona, he was very close from his mother's home, but he didn't visit his mother for 4.5 years. He never left yeshiva. And this is not some art school hagiography telling us this. This is Ettlinger himself describing his life. 4.5 years. He didn't go home for Pesach, didn't do anything. It's shades of Rabbi Akiva. I mean, obviously, you have the problems here. His father was dead. You know, he's the son. Where's the kibbutz of the aim? But we have examples of this. And he says that his mother didn't request it of me either. The shades of Rabbi Akiva are very clear. You find all sorts of stories like this, especially in Haredi works. If those of you who saw the Sfarim blog, my piece last week, I gave you some examples of the sorts of stories from Haredim that with modern people, they don't really ring so well. But people today don't know what to do with stories like this, and there are some who think that they shouldn't be told precisely because of that. But these sorts of stories are a staple of Gedolim literature. But it's significant that this is told about Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer himself. I mean, you have all sorts of stories. I mentioned on my blog, Rabbi Soloveitchik has all sorts of stories. If anyone thinks of Soloveitchik had a modern Orthodox ethos. Just look at the stories he tells in Halachic Man, and it will disabuse you of that notion. So much so that Moshe Sokol and David Singer, in their article on the Rav, believe that these stories he tells are designed to criticize, to mock his family tradition, because he has such anger. It's impossible to believe this, though, with the respect that Rav Soloveitchik had for his father and his grandfather, to the idea that he would tell these stories in order to undermine the Brisker tradition is just too far-fetched. But the stories are shocking. I mean, the day I mentioned also in that blog that I prepare, I saw a eulogy, and I wrote this when, as I was working on these lectures, I read it, where one great rabbi is eulogizing another great rabbi that when he was at a table, like an affair, he'd keep a sefer, a book, under the tablecloth, so whenever he had a free moment, he'd look at it. And someone in the comments replied that there's a story about Rav Moshe Feinstein, just the opposite. When he was in situations like that, he never would do that because it would be seen as offensive. So we see that there's some sensitivity. Just plug in Sefarim blog, two words, into Google, and you'll see it. Now, Hildesheimer, after he left Ettlinger, he went to the University of Halle to study for his doctorate. Halle is in East Germany. And he was one of the very first rabbis to receive a doctorate. I believe the first of the Orthodox rabbis was Rav Nassim Adler, the great chief rabbi of England, the author of the commentary on Uncalus called Netina Laguerre. Now, for many years, Hildesheimer's dissertation was thought to be lost. And if you look in the Jewish Encyclopedia, it says as much. All the biographies say as much. However, and this is one of my first great coups, I was able to get it from the University of Halle, which, as I said, in those days was East Germany. Communist territory. J.J. Weinberg did not go to Halle. J.J. Weinberg, Yehiel Yaakov Weinberg, went to Gießen. Gießen's in the west. Halle's in the east. I don't know of anyone else who went to Halle. But during the communist era, I retrieved the dissertation, and lo and behold, it's written in Latin. All the biographies gave a German title to it. It's written in Latin. It deals with the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Torah. 20 years ago, I gave a copy of it to the family in Israel, and they were supposed to find someone to translate it. Nothing's appeared since then. I don't know what happened. What's the most amazing, though, is that in German dissertations, on the last page, there always was a curriculum vitae giving a little biography. So this handwritten dissertation is no different, except for on the last page, the handwritten curriculum vitae is in Biblical Hebrew. I published that. It's quite fascinating. So where did Hildesheimer stand then? He finishes up. He gets his doctorate. He's a great Talmud Chacham, having studied with Ettlinger. Remember, Ettlinger was functioning at the beginning of the crisis in Orthodoxy. When Reform arrives on the scene and begins to create real fissures in German Jewry. Hildesheimer's career in the second half of the 19th century would meet it head on. And what was the issue? How would Orthodoxy, now it's called Orthodoxy, how would traditional Torah Judaism in Germany respond to the growing irreligiosity, to the fact that Orthodox Jews were now a minority, certainly in the big cities, and reaching that in the small towns as well? By the end of the 19th century, we figure about 20% of Jews were Orthodox. When I say Orthodox, I mean Shomer Shabbat. Is the proper approach to retreat into a spiritual and intellectual ghetto? There couldn't be a physical ghetto anymore. That had been torn down. Or do you attempt to conquer modernity, to bring Torah to bear on all aspects of the modern world? Since it was obvious, from that perspective, that trying to create a ghetto would not work. Now, in a previous class, we spoke about the Chasam Sofer's position. Chadash asr min haTorah. All new is forbidden from the Torah. The Chasam Sofer wrote about how the emancipation was a terrible thing. Jews should be in the ghetto. The only place Jews can live without assimilating is in the ghetto. Hildesheimer obviously didn't share that position. In fact, Hildesheimer and Hirsch believed that the proper approach in modern times and the only approach that would succeed is, as I said before, to meet the challenges head on. So let's speak a little more in detail about this. First, let me say, in a previous class, we spoke about Hirsch and Bamberger, the Würzburger Rav. Bamberger, the old-fashioned German Rav with no secular education, the leading post-sec in Germany, and Hirsch, who certainly was a good Talmudist, but wasn't at the level of a Bamberger. Hirsch was not known as a posek, as one who wrote Tshuvos. He was known for his commentaries on Chumash, on Psalms, on a very different sort of figure, a great preacher. Hildesheimer is really in the middle. Unlike Hirsch, he is a great posek and a Talmudist. Again, I'm not trying to put Hirsch down and say he wasn't a great Talmudist, but compared to people like Bamberger and certainly those in the East, that's not what he was known for. And Hildesheimer had a lot more of the traditional Talmudic learning. He published volumes. They published now, I think, 3 volumes of his Chidushim on Shas. He's published 2 giant volumes of Responsa. We don't have that with Hirsch. In addition, unlike Hirsch, and this would be the great dispute, which I'll get back to later today, Hildesheimer believed in the academic study of Judaism, what was called Wissenschaft des Judentums. Now, what is this academic study of Judaism? And why did Hirsch oppose it? And why did Hildesheimer support it? With the advent of modernity, you have the rise of critical studies. That is critical histories, examinations of developments of Jewish law in every field. In Christianity, in world religions, in politics, everything is being looked at critically. So do Jews simply live in a different world, want nothing to do with that? Or do they also take part in critical, advanced academic studies? Now, what's the problem, though? Well, Torah's never been studied like this before. I don't know if anyone's listening to Rabbi Wieder's shiurim on Wednesday night. You know, this is new ways of studying Talmud, new ways of studying Torah, bringing archaeology to bear, let's say, on the Bible. Looking at comparative Semitics, if you want to understand what this word is in Hebrew that's mentioned in the Torah, let's look at the Arabic, let's look at the Akkadian, let's try to chart the development of the Midrashic traditions. The traditional way of studying Torah is as it's done in the yeshivas to this day. Hirsch was a believer. He believed in studying literature and philosophy, but no critical studies when it comes to our holy texts. That is regarded by him as a blasphemous undertaking. We must study Torah in the traditional way. His novelty is that we have to also study Tanakh and things like that, which have been left out of the curriculum but are part of Torah, but not to study in a new fashion. For Hirsch, you don't think about authorship. Who authored this part of the Talmud? Who authored this section of Mishnah? Are there different layers? You don't start examining who authored the books of the Bible. Let's say, authored the Song of Songs or the Book of Joshua. The Talmud tells you who authored it. So, that's the answer. Now, Steinsaltz, those of you who study with the Steinsaltz Gemara, you can compare the difference of Steinsaltz to the Art Scroll. Art Scroll is traditional Talmud. Steinsaltz, while I wouldn't call it critical in any advanced sense, it certainly uses critical scholarship. You'll have philology, it'll tell you about these words, it'll even have Greek, it'll have pictures. Let's say the Gemara could be speaking about utensils or fences or anything there, and Steinsaltz will show you what it looks like, coins. Steinsaltz will identify the figures who are speaking, what generation they're in. In the yeshiva, when you study Talmud, you have no idea what generation these people are in. You could study a very long sugya that talks about, for example, does a certain item become ritually impure, and you finish the sugya, and you'll know what the halacha is, but if I ask you, well, what item are they referring to? Is it a pot? Is it a pan? Is it a jug? You will never know in a traditional Talmud study, because that's not important. When they describe clothes, you could study the whole thing and get the halachic implications, but won't really know what item of clothes they're talking about. It is not regarded as important. But for the modern critical scholar, this is very important. In fact, Daniel Sperber, in one of the Orthodox Forums volumes, actually has an article on precisely this point, why even halachically there's implications, you know, what clothes Rava wore, things of that nature. Well, this is exactly the same time as Wellhausen, and since you ask, I'll say what I'll say in a few minutes. The only thing off-limits in the rabbinical seminary was the Torah itself. the Pentateuch. That is off limits. No higher critical studies. No examination of authorship, stating as Wellhausen did that Deuteronomy came later, and let's look at J, E, P, and D. However, when it came to Nach, that was on the table. You could look at Isaiah, Israel Hildesheimer's son-in-law, Yaakov Barth, a leading figure in German Orthodoxy, taught at the seminary as well as the University of Berlin. He was one of the world's leading Semitic scholars. He taught the second Isaiah. That is, Isaiah was written by more than one author. He looked at the authorship of books like Job, Song of Songs, described when he believed the Song of Songs was a late work. And it wasn't written by Solomon. In fact, he thought it was originally a book of love poems. He took apart Tanakh. Higher criticism was on the table. The only thing that was off the table was Torah itself. And that created enormous controversy. Hirsch believed that Israel Hildesheimer Seminary was in opposition to traditional Judaism, for both because of Barth, and we'll see next class, or the class after, because of W.C. Hoffman, believe it or not. Okay, good question. Why would Hirsch think that if people are exposed to critical study, secular studies, they won't want critical methodology? Because people, you can create, I mean, it's no different than today. Plenty of people go to university, but they only study certain things. They'll study psychology, they'll study literature, but they won't study Jewish subjects. The Hirschians all had doctorates, but they did not get doctorates in Jewish studies because they thought that that was sui generis. You can't bring, yes, you use critical methodology to study history. If you're studying the Quran, you use critical methodology. But by definition, the Torah is a divine text. Tanakh is a divine text. Therefore, the critical methodologies, which are human creations, are not applicable when it comes to divine works. And the same thing when it comes to halakha. We'll see W.C. Hoffman believed you have to look at the development of Jewish law. Hirsch believed that these are really out of time. For Hoffman, these take place in time, so you have to examine that. Hirsch sees them really outside of time. It's a fundamentalist position, no question about it. The irony is that Hirsch, who wants advanced secular educations, when it comes to Jewish matters, he retreats into what we today would call a fundamentalist position. And I mean, you're saying it doesn't work? Fine, you're right. For many people, it didn't work. Hirsch was a minority in this. Most people in Germany did not follow this approach. And if you know about the Frankfurt community, they were regarded as obscurantists. You know, what's an obscurantist? One who doesn't want enlightenment. Now, today, it's ironic because we look at them as great advocates of secular studies. But in Germany itself, they were regarded as the extremists because they were very dogmatic. And the fact that they wanted secular education, everything's in context. Compared to the rest of German Orthodoxy, they were the extremists. They wouldn't have anything to do with reformers. They wouldn't have anything to do with higher Jewish studies, etc. Two Isaiahs like Ibn Ezra. Exactly. That's what Barth said. He said Ibn Ezra, he said Ibn Ezra believed in the second Isaiah. He brought proofs. He thought that even Talmudic rabbis believed in the second Isaiah and that they didn't. And that the Talmudic authorships, if you look at Abarbanel and others, they don't accept the authorships given by the Talmud, who wrote this book, who wrote that book. So he believes he was following in this path. Now, it's interesting that Hildesheimer himself attacked the second Isaiah theory. He attacked what was going on in Breslau at Frankl's institution. He said they taught the second Isaiah. But then when his son-in-law started teaching it, he never again said another word, because Yaakov Barth was a great tzaddik and a Talmud Chacham, and Hildesheimer let him teach this at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. And this is really no different than Bar Ilan University, Yeshiva University. If you go there, the only thing I believe that's off the table is higher criticism. James Kugel, who's certainly a higher critic, he doesn't teach it at Bar Ilan, as far as I know. At Yeshiva University won't teach it. But everything else is on the table. You could speak about, you know, different sections of the book of Zechariah and influences on it, etc. No, W.C. Hoffman did not take this to the Pentateuch level, and we'll talk about that in two classes. That's where he said we fall back on faith. And the critics of Hoffman said if the method is good, if it's a good method, if you can use it for Mishnah and you could use it for Nach, How can you say you can't use it for Torah? They said it's arbitrary. And Hoffman's response, you see this in the introduction to Vayikra, was that there's certain things we must accept on faith. There aren't that many for people like Hoffman. But this is one of the things you have to accept on faith, that the higher criticism is mistaken, and that even if it appears correct on faith, we have to reject it. There's two types of criticism. There's lower criticism and higher criticism. And lower criticism, by the way, even of Torah, was acceptable to many people in the German Orthodoxy. Lower criticism deals with words. You say, is this a correct word? It is we say girsa. You have words in the Torah that are not clear. Is there a mistake here? You look at the Septuagint, they have a different word. Maybe, for example, we read not too long ago, do you recall, when Yitzchak, right after he finished with the Akedah, he didn't sacrifice Yitzchak, he looks and he sees an Ayil, right, which is caught in the thicket. And over there it says, what is the word, Ayil Achar? And everyone wants to know, what's this business of Achar? What do you mean, what's Achar mean there? A lower criticism would say it's a mistake, and the word should be Echad. And it reads perfectly, Ayil Echad. Now, this obviously is somewhat radical because you're tampering with the Torah, but Rav Chaim Hirschenstein already has a tshuva in which he says that that is permissible, as long as you don't change the Torah text that we use in shul. But simply to suggest that there's a mistake in the Torah text, that's okay, because we find Rashi's, where Rashi, in a few weeks, we're going to get to a Rashi, where he says, what is this extra vav at the beginning of the word come to teach us? And if you look in our Torah text, we don't have that vav. So, and if you look in the Talmud mentions words, and we don't have those words. How to spell a totafot. They derive all sorts of things, and we don't have that. So that's lower criticism. Kriyuchtiv, okay. Tikune sofrim, et cetera, all these things. Higher criticism is, Avi points out correctly, but it's source criticism. That is, you take the text, and you try to determine where each part of the text. So Wellhausen argued that there were four documents. And just look at the first two chapters of Genesis. The first chapter of Genesis just tells a quick story. The second chapter elaborates on it. So he argued that these come from two separate sources that were put together. And if you look, he claimed that the use of the word Elohim versus Hashem's name, the Tetragrammaton, you could see that they come from different sources. That one source knew one name and the other source knew another name. And Hoffman devotes not only his commentary, but an entire book, which has now been translated in English. It was a master's dissertation at McGill University, refuting Wellhausen's ideas. And that's the way it stood in Orthodoxy for a long time, until Mordechai Breuer, who passed away earlier last year, the great biblical scholar, he argued that Wellhausen's right. Everything Wellhausen pointed to is 100% correct. And if this was a human document, we would have to conclude that there's two authors and all these things Wellhausen said, even three or four authors, and that Hoffman's wrong. But we can't apply human categories because it's a divine document. But we can use all of Wellhausen's insights to show us what the Torah is really coming to teach us. And maybe in a future class we can talk about the Breuer revolution in Torah study, which really created a new approach. So that's higher criticisms. And yes, as Zatzi thankfully points out, you can all see Shapiro's Limits of Orthodox Theology, and you get all sorts of stuff in this regard. Okay, let's move on. Obviously, if Hildesheimer is going to be an advocate of the critical study of Jewish texts, you have to raise the question, is this to replace traditional study or in addition to? In places like Breslau or the Jewish Theological Seminary of America, really, they replaced it. Critical study was all they did. And again, I just repeat, if any of you are listening to Rabbi Weider's classes, I'm not listening to them, but I know the sort of things he does. It could be, and there have been many great scholars, Talmidei Chachamim, who have been exposed to people like Rabbi Weider, and immediately they were bitten. And they couldn't go back to traditional Talmud study. One of the most famous examples, some of you might have had him as a teacher, was Meir Simcha Feldblum. Meir Feldblum, a Holocaust survivor, comes to the United States, already a great Talmud Chacham. I mean, he's a European guy. He had studied at European youth. They knew much more than all the Americans. He becomes a great student of Rav Soloveitchik. He even becomes a Rosh Yeshiva at Yeshiva YYU. And then he decides to take a few courses at Revel, and he falls under the spell of Avraham Weiss, who at that time was maybe the greatest critical Talmudic scholar in the world. You know, he took the Talmudic section, he took the various sugyas, and he took them apart, and he showed what where the strands were from, how sometimes the Amoraim didn't always have all the information that the Tanaim had, and if the Amoraim had this information, they wouldn't have these problems. And Feldblum becomes a major, major academic scholar, and it's no accident. For some people, the sorts of questions that the Talmud asks and that Tosos asks, you do an end run around them by going right to the source. You look at Halachic Midrash, and it's a very different methodology. And there are many people who can never go back to traditional Talmud study after having this. Yeah, Feldblum has great stuff, and the Rav was always very upset with this. The Rav said that Professor Weiss stole my mayor. That, because as I said, the Rav had a very close relationship with Mayor Feldblum, and he became a critical scholar. And just to give you a little bit of history of Yeshiva University, this then became a huge problem because Rav Schechter, representing the right wing, became a major enemy of Feldblum. So much so he wouldn't even answer to his Kaddish. He thought that what Feldblum was doing was mamish heresy. And this created a huge split at Yeshiva because, you know, are you going with the traditional approach or are you going with the more academic approach? Lieberman, by the way, does not engage in higher criticism. Lieberman is traditional Talmud study, but simply with a much wider breadth. It's semi-critical in that he's using Greek and he's looking at history, but he's only doing lower criticism. And realia. Realia is to tell you about, you know, the language, you know, Hellenism, you know, what type of, you know, maybe some of the Greek ideas in the air. But he's not doing what Halivni does. He's not doing what Feldblum does or what Avram Weiss did. That is to take apart the Talmudic sugya and to try to trace it, where it comes from. And this helps you answer all sorts of questions because when you start getting into the critical mode, you look at a lot of the things, and those of you here who have studied Talmud, let me give you an example. You have a Mishnah, and then there's a Braisa, which seems to contradict it, and then the Talmud will conclude, well, this Mishnah must be referring to this case, you know, and it gives you some crazy case that, you know, that hardly ever happens, or only this sort of case. And if you have any historical sense, your question has to be, well, if that's what the Mishnah meant, then why didn't the Mishnah say it? If the Mishnah said a specific halakha, it certainly didn't mean in this, you know, far-out case. So much so that the Vilna Gaon says that when it comes to Mishnah, there's pshat and there's drash. And that we follow the drash. Just like in Torah, there's pshat and drash, the Talmud often gives the drash. What the Vilna Gaon was saying, and then the Tziv elaborates on this, is that when the Talmud gives these explanations, that's really not what the Mishnah meant, but it's sort of the Talmud knew what the halacha was from tradition or some other reason, and they try to interpret the Mishnah in accordance with that, but that's not what the Mishnah meant historically. But most people don't have that understanding, and if you're a critical scholar, you'll look at the Yerushalmi, for example, and you'll see that the Yerushalmi doesn't provide this far-fetched answer. It interprets it very differently, straightforward, and you'll redo the sugya. What about the halacha, though? The halacha is based on the conclusion of the Babylonian Talmud, and if you've concluded that the Amoraim were missing certain information in the Tosefta, let's say, and had they had this information, they wouldn't have concluded the halacha this way. They would have concluded it like it appears in the Tosefta. Do you change halacha? No. Feldblum said, you don't change halacha. We have a Masora. But for many people, this is very problematic. This goes back to a famous Tosos Yom Tov in Nazir. Tractate Nazir, you look at it, Chapter 5, Mishnah 5, where the Tosos Yom Tov says there's nothing wrong with interpreting the Mishnah against how the Talmud interprets it, as long as you don't do it halacha l'maisa. But when those of you who are doing Daf Yomi, pay attention especially. All the times the Gemara says they answer the problem by saying, well, it must be referring to case X. Ask yourself, is that really what the Mishnah means? In all those cases, the academic scholars will say, this is not what the Mishnah means, that this is a forced answer. Let's find the true answer. So you can either view this as disrespectful, as whatever, however you view it, it is not traditional Torah study. Yes, Leis HaLivni does higher criticism. It's heresy for some people, first of all, because no one did it till recently. And if the Rishonim didn't do it, how can you do it? It's heresy that people think because it undermines proper Talmud study, and it's undermining it. It's putting the halacha at risk, because now you're showing that the conclusions of the Amoraim were based on falsehoods. The Sri Deyesh, though, replies to all this, and he says that it is not heresy, and it's not problematic, and he also engages in higher criticism of the Sri Deyesh. But it is a big dispute. And from experience, I can tell you that in the yeshiva world, they don't even know what this is, and that's good, perhaps, because it is for the Yechidei Skula. I don't know if Shinels does that, do you think? I don't think so. Shinels is focused on the Daf, right? I don't use Shinels that often, but does Shinels ever tell you, say anything like there's another way of interpreting this, not the way the Talmud does? Even look at the beginning of Bava Metzia. That's the classic case, where if you look into Tiferes Yisrael, he brings down there Rav Menashe of Ilya, who interprets the Mishnah against the Talmud. I don't think Steinsaltz would bring such an explanation. Maybe there are a case here and there. Steinsaltz is critical in the lower critical sense and in the realia sense. Realia, like I said, you know, what clothes they wore, that sort of thing, the Lieberman sense. I don't think he engages in higher criticism of the sort of the Revadim method that goes on in Israel or any of these other things. No, it doesn't undermine Torah Misinai. Torah Misinai is just... is the Torah. What it undermines is 2,000 years of how the Talmud was understood. Because you're saying that the Amoraim did not have all the information, therefore they misinterpreted the Mishnah. And yes, you're saying, but when it comes to Halacha, we're not going to change Halacha. We're going to follow what the Amoraim said. But the idea is, you're saying that the Amoraim were lacking information, and you're going to give a better shot than the Amoraim. That is quite radical. I mean, now it's standard at Bar Ilan and Yeshiva and all university. But when this first began in the 19th century, this was, and we'll see what Hirsch says about Hoffman, because Hoffman does this with the Mishnah. Yes, when I said they didn't provide higher criticism, they didn't provide Jewish to the Chumash. That was off limits. Okay, yeah, Brian, background. Steinsaltz is semi-critical, I would say, and... it's not higher criticism, it's mostly lower criticism with realia. So I think you can see now why someone like Hirsch would see this as, but it's not just Hirsch. Go to your typical rabbi, go to your typical yeshiva, and show them that Tiferes Yisrael. That Tiferes Yisrael created enormous controversy. People wanted to cut it out and ban it, that Tiferes Yisrael. But ask people, is it my experience when I was once learning in the Boston Kollel? Once we had one of these far-fetched answers in Arvei Pesachim, if you remember Arvei Pesachim, Oral Arbasar, when it talks about how you're supposed to search for chametz with the, you know, the how you line up the boxes, you know, if you, you know, the different rows, it was very far-fetched, and I tried to engage my chavrusos in the kolal that maybe that's not what the Mishnah meant. And he had no clue what I was talking about, because if the Gemara says that's what it means, then that's what it means. Now, of course, if I'd show him the Yerushalmi, maybe the Yerushalmi interprets it differently. I mean, then maybe we can move somewhere, but this is a totally new way of studying Talmud. Those who are interested, I call your attention to the volume Printing the Talmud. Printing the Talmud was published by Yeshiva University last year, or 2 years ago, and they had this beautiful exhibition at the Yeshiva University Museum, some of you were probably there, on the history of the Talmud. And they published a nice volume, and I have an essay in there that discusses, it's called From... Wissenschaft and Brisk to Daf Yomi. I also quote Rav Dunner, who was the chief rabbi of Amsterdam. He went so far as to say that there are certain passages in the Talmud which were put in by the heretics, the mockers of the sages, and that people didn't know about it for all this time. For example, this was in Daf Yomi not too long ago. Those who are doing it, remember the case of an Amora? He comes to a city, and he says, I want to find a woman, a wife for the night. And everywhere he'd go, he'd find a wife for a night. Rav Dunner, who was a big posek, he says that this is mocking the rabbis. Is it Ravo did it, or Rav, a holy rabbi, would never do something like that. Or how about the case where the Gemara speaks about what happens if a man falls off the roof? And as he's falling down, you all know this, he has sex with a woman as he's falling down. Now, just try to imagine the metzius of this. I mean, and this is taken as a serious, they discuss it, and Rav Duner says this was put in by some heretics to mock the rabbis, to make fun of them, the way they get into all the nitty-gritty details. And Rabbi Breuer, Hirsch's son-in-law, threatened to put Duner in Cherem if he didn't withdraw his Perush. His Perush is printed, you can get it by Mossad Rav Kook, and Duner refused. And he never went ahead with the Cherem, but Rav Breuer said this is apikorsis, to say that for 2,000 years, say that the Ramban and Rashi and the rest of them studied this text, and they took it seriously, and you're saying that they had the wool pulled over their eyes, but Rav Duner was, and he had, I mean, Rav Duner was certain that this was put in by people mocking our holy sages. And Rav Duner's Perush, if you want to see it, Chidushei HaRav Yosef C. Duner, the whole Perush is higher criticism of the Talmud. And as I said, it was reprinted by Mossad HaRav Kook. Okay, just a few more questions before we go on. Now, Yaakov Ellman is higher criticism. So Weider draws the distinction, you're saying, between the religious experience and scientific study. That's not what Hildesheimer and the rest believed. They believe that there's religious, and that's certainly not what Feldblum believed, and I wondered, could Weider really believe that? There's no religious value to scientific study? It doesn't illuminate Torah? I mean, if you ask Jacob Barth, when he looked at the Akkadian loanwords to give an explanation for a word in Torah, which Hirsch said is off-limits, that's Talmud Torah. When Hoffman was studying, I mean, this helps illuminate Torah. So, I mean, this idea that never the two shall meet. Maybe he's saying when it comes to halacha, but if he's saying that the scientific method can't be brought into the Beit Midrash, that's something that in Berlin, remember, Frankfurt is Hirsch, Berlin is Hildesheimer, they believe this is brought into the Beit Midrash together with the critical. And if you look at Hoffman's Chuvot, for example, he has in the back there, he has all sorts of critical studies. So they are brought in, according to him. And the Sri Deish, Volume 4, his Mechkarim B'Talmud, it's a beautiful conglomeration, a beautiful synthesis of the traditional method and the critical method. So I'm very troubled to hear that Rabbi Weider thinks that he spends all this time, he wrote a doctoral dissertation, he teaches this, and it has no Beit Midrash value? Okay. Yes, and good point by Rabbi Hirsch. The Rav is on the exact same page on this issue. The Rav was not in favor of Wissenschaft, and not just him. His son-in-law, Rav Lichtenstein, not Rav Tversky, Rav Lichtenstein, what was his dissertation in? English literature. All the Berlin people got their dissertations in academic Jewish studies. The Rav and Rav Lichtenstein do not like critical studies, so much so that one of the Rav's sons, Meir Lichtenstein, who does critical Talmud study, he left. I was told that he felt he couldn't be comfortable there because his father is so opposed to it. So he went to Yeshivat Male Gilboa, I believe, that's where he's at. And they do, Rabigman, they do critical Talmud study, and they see this as part of the expansion of Torah. Look at the Das Mikra series. Das Mikra series is really critical to a certain extent Torah study within a framework of traditional faith. That's new. And so there are people who believe in bringing it in, but not the Rav, and Rav Lichtenstein, as those who've been to Gush know, he has no interest in this, and he even is opposed to it. So we see that his father's not pleased with his choice. But, you know, that's, people often rebel, and smart families, you know, the kids go off and do their own things. So that's nice. Okay, let's move on. I think we have a sense now of what Berlin was like as opposed to Frankfurt. But before we get to Berlin, we have to make a detour to Hungary first, because this was Hildesheimer's ideology, but he wasn't able to implement it until being in Hungary for a bit, and then he returns. Because after finishing yeshiva and the university, he certainly expected to stay in Germany, but he received a call from Eisenstadt, which in those days was in Hungary. The community had not had a rabbi for 11 years. Why not? Because they couldn't agree on a rabbi. You had reformers in there who had nothing to do with the rabbi, but then so they weren't interested. And you had modern Orthodox and what we would call right-wing Orthodox, really fanatical Orthodox. And they could not agree on who to choose. So for 11 years, it was empty. Now, Eisenstadt has had great, great Rabbanim. The Maram Ash, he's called. Maram Eisenstadt. Ash stands for Aleph Shin, Eisenstadt. They finally agreed on choosing Hildesheimer. The extremists, who really were fanatical Hasidim, as we'll see, they didn't want Hildesheimer. Why not? Because he was a rabbi doctor. In Germany, rabbi doctor was a, as we say, a shavach. It's a positive thing. In Hungary, it's lignai. It's a bad thing. I don't know America today. It's interesting. There was a time when rabbi doctors were very much in demand and people liked them. I think today, many shuls dafka don't want the rabbi doctor. I don't know. But in Hungary at that time, you had the modern, what we'll call the German neo-orthodox types, the one who spoke German. They weren't speaking Yiddish anymore. This is the Austro-Hungarian Empire. The ones who wanted their children to have modern education. They wanted a German orthodoxy in Hungary. And then you had the extremists. Hungary's always had very extreme elements to that, as we'll see right now. And the majority wanted Hildesheimer. Traditional Judaism was losing in Hungary, just like in Germany. Reform was on the march, a radical reform. Young people were leaving Torah and Mitzvos. Hildesheimer had the opportunity. The first person ever to have this opportunity in Hungary of creating a different type of orthodoxy. One, the choice was radical reform or extremist Hasidut, in which obviously secular studies, university, speaking the vernacular, all these things were off limits. No middle ground. Hildesheimer takes this opportunity, and he's going to save Hungarian Orthodoxy by bringing the approach of Ettlinger, and now his approach as well, to Germany, to Hungary, to create a new type of a neo-Orthodox, a modern Orthodox, whatever you want to call it. One which didn't need to choose between tradition, between Torah and the modern world, but one that could live in the modern world and still be a Torah Jew. Now, when he went there, part of the agreement was that the community would fund a yeshiva for him. As we spoke last class, yeshivas in those days were local institutions funded from the community. The Volozhin yeshiva, which did exist at this time, but that was in Lithuania, was the only yeshiva in the world which had a international focus, in which from all over Lithuania and Poland, they tried to raise money for it. So he starts with 10 students. He creates his own curriculum. And he establishes that everything be taught in German, not Yiddish. There's no future for Yiddish in the modern world. The yeshiva, which opened in 1851, was the first yeshiva in Central and Western Europe, in 1851, to include secular subjects. All the yeshivas we have today, the Yitramaz, Flatbush Maimonides, all of them, they all go back to Hildesheimer. Because the way it worked is that following this, then they open up in Germany, and then in America. This is the Hildesheimer yeshiva is the first yeshiva. There were apparently some yeshivas in Italy in the 17th century that had secular subjects. But then they closed, and certainly in Western and Central Europe, Hildesheimer's was the first yeshiva to combine Torah and secular subjects. Okay, let me stop for a second here. We'll go back for a second because there's some questions. The Rav thought that Wissenschaft, I think he thought it was false. He was a traditional Talmudist. I heard from someone that he thought that there were certain things about it that were positive, but this is not the proper way to study Torah. He didn't think it was heresy or anything like that. We know that. And his own son, by the way, he spoke about Rav Lichtenstein's son going a different path. His own son, Chaim Soloveitchik, he doesn't become a Rosh Hashiva. He becomes a Wissenschaft scholar. You know, one who looks at halacha critically, the development of halacha, all the thing that the Hirshians and his own father didn't like, that they wanted to look at it differently. Do some Orthodox rabbis hide their doctorates today? I do not know. Good question. I'm not sure. Okay, returning to Hungary. One more question. Yes, the altar of Kelm's yeshiva came much later. It came like in the 1880s, even 1890s, 1870s, late 1870s, 1880s. That's when it came. The altar of, for those who don't know, one of Yisrael Salanter's disciples, Rav Simcha Zissel of Kelm, he opened the first yeshiva in Eastern Europe, which had secular subjects, and he did it at Rav Yisrael Salanter's approval, although Rousseau Solander never visited it because he said that people will assume that I'm in support of it generally, and they'll open other yeshivas, and he said he's only in support of it when his own student, who he trusts, is doing it. That yeshiva, and then after that yeshiva, he had Reines' yeshiva in Lida, which continued, I believe, to World War One, and you had Chaim Chernovitz's yeshiva, but the Kelm yeshiva was the first one to be opened, although in Volozhin, which preceded, Kelm yeshiva was opened dafka to do Torah and Sekhar studies, but in the Volozhin yeshiva, before that, they were already teaching secular studies because the government required it. Yeah, no, Lida is a different yeshiva. Lida is Rav Reines' yeshiva. And Rav Reines' yeshiva was radical not just because of the secular studies, but he too had his own way of studying Talmud, God willing, we'll have future sessions. We can do a whole session on Rav Reines. We'll do a couple of sessions on Rousseau Solander. Rousseau Solander, he got this idea of secular studies because he had spent so much time in Germany, where he became very friendly with Hirsch, and he was convinced that you needed secular studies for certain segments. He even wanted the Talmud to be translated into German. He wanted Jewish studies to be taught at Russian universities because that would show people that it was a serious discipline. So there's a lot to talk about them as well. What did the extremists do? The extremists were very unhappy. Remember what it is in Eastern, in Europe, and Central Europe, the rub of a community is the government recognized rabbi. There's no other rabbis recognized. You can have another little synagogue, but he's not recognized, and the salary doesn't go to him, and the rabbi controls everything. They tried to get the government to shut his yeshiva down. Unfortunately, Jews have often fought amongst themselves, and have often turned to the government to try to shut things down. I mentioned in his blog, on the Svarim blog, those who might have seen it, that the great dispute in Yemen, so they get Rabbi Kafach thrown in jail. The Misnagdim got Rav Shneur Zalman of Vladi thrown in jail. Unfortunately, even Orthodox Jews have a tendency to go to the government, and I hope by now we've learned our lessons. But they tried to get the government to shut it down, and how they do that, after all, what's wrong with Hildesheimer opening yeshiva? Remember, this is after 1848. Governments, there was the revolution, and it was beaten back by the governments. Governments are afraid of revolution. The forces of reaction are coming into are in power. They told the government, they tried to get the government to shut it down by saying that it was going to lead to revolutionary thought. So basically, they're accusing Hildesheimer of being a traitor, of teaching treasonous ideas. It's going to be a hotbed of revolution. Incredible. But that's what they did. Yeah, Hildesheimer was able to stop it because it's nonsense. It will be next class, I'll speak in more detail about the extremist opposition to Hildesheimer, because it really is as fanatical as you get. But I should mention also that the Reform were very opposed to him and his yeshiva also. The Reform understood that traditional orthodoxy was doomed in Hungary, at least as a major force, the way it used to be, and that young people were not going to be attracted to extremist Hasidut. Young people wanted to get jobs and go to the university, and therefore they wanted there to be this extremist Hasidut, because then it was very obvious what they were against. The problem with Hildesheimer and his yeshiva was, here you had a different type of orthodoxy. No longer could the Reform claim that the Orthodox are obscurantists and opponents of education, and they want to keep you poor and uneducated and not having decent jobs. They couldn't say that because Hildesheimer was preaching a different method. So what did they argue? They polemicized against Hildesheimer's yeshiva, saying that parents who send their kids there will not get a good secular education. It's a waste. No different than when the day school movement started in America. All these people who opposed day schools, what did they say? You won't get a good secular education there, and people still say it. That's why it's so important to have a strong secular education. They said the same thing about Hildesheimer's yeshiva, that it's not a yeshiva, and it's not a school, because it's not a real yeshiva, and it's not a real school. It's, you're going to come out there, you're not going to be ready for the modern, the real world. So we see he's caught on both sides. I see we're already at the end. We will pick up next class with this, and we'll see Hildesheimer's great achievement and also great failures in Hungary, because even a greater man as he was not able to take on an entire country. And the fanatical Hasidim who were there, who even were able to silence people like the Maharam Shik and the Kassav Sofer were too strong. He must therefore move on to Berlin, where he, together with Hirsch, becomes the most important figures in 19th century Germany, and who still influences us till this day. Are there any further comments or questions? We had a lot we did today, even a lot off the topic, but very important.
Mark, you talked about his yeshiva. Are we talking about a school of advanced study or something that started at a more elementary level?
Okay, that's a very good question. Today, of course, the word yeshiva is used for everything. Day schools are all called yeshivas. This was a yeshiva in the sense that they studied Talmud. And in addition, they had secular studies. The students were not as old as you would find in Volozhin. But why not call it a yeshiva? Basically, it's a yeshiva, Torah study, which they also had secular studies. Fundamentally, it's no different than any other yeshiva. It wasn't like we have today where, truth be told, I don't know, why can't we call the day schools yeshivas also? Yeshivas don't need to be exclusive study of Talmud. I don't know if you call a place like Ramazi yeshiva, because the amount of time they study Talmud is very small. But in a Hildesheimer's yeshiva, if you're studying Talmud for 7 hours a day and then doing some English, some secular subjects, that's a yeshiva in the full sense of a word. So I don't know where you draw the line between day school and yeshiva. I went to a day school. We studied Talmud from 8:30 to like 1. So, I mean, that's yeshiva. So it was the yeshiva. And it was primarily, it was started as yeshiva. It was a yeshiva that added secular subjects. It wasn't a Jewish school that they decided to add some Torah subjects. It was started as a yeshiva together with secular subjects. And Hildesheimer, by the way, taught some secular subjects. He taught math, by the way. How does Hildesheimer influence us today? Well, hold on till the end of next class and we will see. But, I mean, I can tell you, just to anticipate, everything they do at Bar-Ilan University, everything they do at Bernard Grumbel Graduate School, Orthodox Judaism's involvement with critical academic studies of Judaism all goes back to Hildesheimer and the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. He gave it to Hechsher, the Hashkacha, when Hirsch said it was misguided, blasphemous, and sometimes even heretical. He trained, the seminary trained one generation under him, and then it lasted two more generations, so three generations of critical academic scholars combining Torah and higher academic Jewish studies. That all goes back to Israel Hildesheimer. So his influence is enormous. Even the American rabbinate, Leo Jung. I mean, that sort of rabbi comes out of Berlin. A whole era was influenced by the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin in a whole way. Bar-Ilan University's Talmud department would be unimaginable. Bernard Revel Graduate School. This all goes back to the German Orthodoxy and their engagement with critical Talmud study. As I said, it would have happened already, but this provided the Hechsher. This showed people that it was okay, that you could do it, and there was nothing wrong with it. Only in the U.S. are they all called yeshivas today. What are they called? Day schools elsewhere? I don't know. When I was growing up, we even referred to women's yeshivas. Some people don't want to call it yeshivas because they want to reserve the name yeshivas for the yeshiva gedolos where they only study Torah all day. But it seems to me that that's sort of giving in. Well, why does a yeshiva need to only be a place where they study Torah? I mean, we have great yeshivas like Lida and Kelm where they study secular subjects, and Eisenstadt in the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary they study Jewish history, Jewish philosophy. So I don't see it's a misuse of the term to refer to schools I went to as yeshivas. But I understand why some purists want to keep it, anything that has secular subjects, they want to take the word yeshiva away. But by that token, then Yeshiva University is not a real yeshiva. So I don't think we would want to buy into that.
Lots of people say that anyway.
Mark.
Yeah, kids were older than 13 there. You had 14, 15, 16. You can go up to like 16 or 17. Then it was time to go up to the university. But don't forget, in many of the great yeshivas in Eastern Europe, the kids only remain there till 17, I'd say, till 16 or 17. Then they went to work, or sometimes people got married at 18, and then they went off. We didn't have people in the typical yeshiva bacher was not 25, 26 years old. They became rabbis, and then they went off. They became rabbanim at 19. I mean, if you look at how old many people were in Volozhin, you think of, you know, they're 13, 14, 15 years old. We have this sense sometimes they are dealing with people in their 20s and late 20s, like if you go to Lakewood today. But most of the people were young people. Just look at how old they were when they got their first rabbanus. Hildesheimer, though, stayed long. I see from my notes here, he got to Ettlinger's yeshiva when he was 17, and he stayed there till he was 22. And you had people. We know in Volozhin even you had people who were older. But many people, Yechiel Weinberg has a recollection of Rav Aaron Cutler at the yeshiva, of the Slobodka. And now he knew Rav Aaron Cutler there, and Rav Aaron Cutler was a bit of a kanai even in Slobodka. And if you look at the dates, when Rav Aaron was there and when Yechiel Weinberg was there, he knew him when he was like 13 years old. So, I mean, it in that respect, it's interesting. But you didn't have people 23, 24, 25 in Hildesheimer's yeshiva at Eisenstadt, but you did have them in Berlin at the rabbinical seminary. Okay.
What?
Yeah.
Proportionately, what was the, you know, the size of the Berlin School of Orthodoxy relative to all of European Jewry?
Well, when you say the Berlin School, when I use the term Berlin, I'm talking about the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary and the intellectuals around it. But the ideology of Berlin was found in other places, Germany also. There's nothing like this in Eastern Europe. I mean, it is the typical, you could fit all the people who shared the Berlin, I think if you're talking about the Berlin philosophy, you could fit them in the Volozhin Yeshiva. I mean, there are not that many of them. The typical Jew in those days was an East European Talmud Chacham, that is a typical Orthodox scholar. In Germany, the idea was it's not enough to be a typical scholar. It's not enough just to be a Talmud Chacham. That's not the modern world. And in a sense, Rav Soloveitchik argues that Rav Chaim Brisker understood this. And although he didn't go the route of academic Jewish studies, obviously, the Rav says that Rav Chaim realized that in the modern world, Talmud study, the way it had always been studied, would not be good for the new generation, and it would never attract them. You need something new. So whereas in Germany, what was new was an academic critical approach together with traditional, the Rav says that Rav Chaim created this new model, and that this for his new model, the Brisker method of Torah study carried out in the corners of the Brisker method is as advanced and sophisticated as the most, you know, deep philosophical concepts. And his point was that Talmud Torah, Brisker style, is the equivalent of what the modern world needs, sophisticated Torah study. In Berlin, sophisticated Torah study meant academic studies joined with critical studies. And for Chaim Brisker, it meant the Brisker approach. But they both agreed that in the modern world, the traditional Torah study, maybe let's say how the Sephardim practice it or something, that doesn't work. Something about it is unsophisticated, and it's not going to draw the people. If they can study physics, or if they can study Kant, something about traditional Torah study isn't going to keep them. And it bears thinking about, what is this? And it shows that even Torah study must move to higher levels. The Baalei Tosfos, is it any accident that in the era of medieval times, that's the time of the scholastic scholars, and that they were doing similar things? Torah study rises to meet the various challenges. But it raises some thoughts. You know, what does this mean about traditional Torah study then? It's not sophisticated. The Rav famously says that Torah study carried out prior to Rav Chaim, those Torah scholars were engaged. They had kiddushin with the Torah. They were not married to the Torah. This is a radical thing to say. What, the Chacham Sofer was not married to the Torah? His point, though, is that it's like kissing the bride through the veil. You know, you're really not getting to the meat, the heart of it. That Rav Chaim is giving you such an advanced, sophisticated Torah study that maybe the old way was sufficient in 18th century, early 19th century, but in the modern world, when the sciences and when the philosophers are sophisticated, Torah needs to be sophisticated. And anyone who comes from the Brisker tradition knows that there's a lot of arrogance and pride in their method, and that they really believe that this is the only proper method of Torah study if you want to be a sophisticated Torah Jew. It was the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary was not called a yeshiva. It was not called a yeshiva for reasons we'll talk about next class, because a yeshiva, classically, and this maybe is why we can't call the day schools yeshivas. I don't know. What is a yeshiva? Yeshiva, you sit and learn, right? There's no tests. There's no end. You just learn, and you're there for 10 years, 5 years. No one tells you what to do. And dafka, you don't learn yoredeya and practical hacha. You learn for theory. In Germany, such a concept, that's someone that they call it patronus. You know, you're just sitting and learning. In Germany, everyone has to have a purpose. You know, you have to have a goal. You have to do something. You have to get somewhere. Well, you spend 10 years in yeshiva. I mean, you have to graduate. You have to get out. So the seminary had goals. It had a place you're going. It had classes. It had levels. You go to Volozhin, you just sit in the basement and learn. So in that sense, they didn't want to call it a yeshiva. And there's also a negative view of yeshivas. Do you know that when Rav Shlomo Breuer, Hirsch's son-in-law, wanted to open a yeshiva in Frankfurt, because Hirsch never had a yeshiva, he had a day school where they studied very little Torah, the Orthodox community of Frankfurt refused to go along with it. They refused to fund it. Breuer had to get the money from elsewhere because the Jews in Frankfurt, the ones who are so opposed to Hildesheimer, the what we called the very dogmatic types, they argued that German Jews don't need yeshivas. That's not what a Torah. That's not what it means to be a Torah Jew, to sit and be a batlan, to just sit for 10 years. No, that it's about a pious community. So the idea of yeshivas was not something that in Germany they liked, and it took a while before Breuer was able to bring them around. It wasn't for another 20 years, and by World War II, you can really say, and Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg says this in his letter to Chaim Moshe Grzinski, that the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary is a yeshiva in the full sense of the word. Because what it means is that people had a sense now of Torah lishma, not Torah study in order to get a goal, in order to become a musmach to get a job. Torah study for its own sake. The Chovei Torah is a rabbinical seminary. It's not a yeshiva. In other words, you're there, you go there for 3 years or 4 years, there's a goal, there's classes. That's not a yeshiva. A yeshiva is really where you sit, and there's no goals. You just sit. There's a famous story, I know Rabbi Kaffin has told it a number of times, where this guy in Lakewood, like, goes through a red light or something, and the policeman stops him, give him a ticket, and he says, so you're at the yeshiva, how long have you been there? And he says, 10 years. And he says, you must be the dumbest guy in the yeshiva. 10 years, and you still haven't graduated. But, of course, that's the beauty of the yeshiva, that there is no graduation. And if you read Halachic Man, the Briskers, they put down practical learning. And that you don't want to go out unless you're forced to. You want to stay in the yeshiva. You want to stay in theoretical learning. And it's a different model. But we'll see how the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary does develop into a yeshiva where Torah lishma is valuable and Brisker learning and Talmud study. Look, if you're in an institution where the focus is on practical halakha, yoredeya, in order to know how to paskin a shaila in Basar B'chalav, that's not a yeshiva. That's a seminary. That you're training people to be technicians of Jewish law. However, by the time you get to Rav Avraham Elia Kaplan, Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg, where Talmud study lishma is at the center of the curriculum, then you're at a yeshiva. Okay, well, this was very enlightening. Thank you for all the questions. God willing, we will pick up right where we left off next Monday night.